From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. Today is the 20th anniversary of John Lennon's death. On this Fresh Air, we remember him. Cynthia Lennon, his first wife, recalls hiding their marriage to keep fans happy, and then the changes Lennon went through as his life changed. Also, we hear from Yoko Ono, and believe it or not, the threat Lennon posed to the Nixon White House. We talk with John Wiener about the FBI's secret files on him. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Proof of Life, starring Meg Ryan and Russell Crowe. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush campaign is asking a federal appeals court to overturn today's ruling by the Florida Supreme Court. The divided Florida High Court ordered more recounts for Vice President Al Gore. The 4-3 opinion dealt a blow to the Bush campaign in overruling a decision earlier this week by Circuit Judge N. Sanders Sauls. NPR's Chad Pergram reports.
The court required an immediate recount of 9,000 ballots in Miami-Dade County, which the Gore team had asked Judge Sauls for. Plus, it gave the Gore team some things it didn't request, such as certifying previous hand counts. That added 383 votes to Gore's camp and sliced Bush's statewide advantage over Gore to just more than 150 votes. And the court ordered a statewide recount of undervoted ballots, ballots that lacked a mark for president. The court said in that count, a vote will be tallied where there is, quote, a clear intention of the voter. That's the standard set by the Florida legislature. Justice Major Harding wrote a dissenting opinion in the case, saying the Gore side failed to carry its burden of proof. In his opinion, Harding compared the Gore arguments to a quote by the late football coach Vince Lombardi. We didn't lose the game. We just ran out of time. Chad Pergram, NPR News, Washington.
James Baker, a top advisor to the Bush campaign, denounced the Florida Supreme Court decision, saying it won't stand up legally or constitutionally.
This is what happens when, for the first time in modern history, a candidate resorts to lawsuits to try to overturn the outcome of an election for president. It is very sad. It is sad for Florida. It is sad for the nation, and it is sad for our democracy.
Bush campaign advisor James Baker. A Kremlin commission has recommended that convicted spy Edmund Pope be freed. The White House is hoping President Vladimir Putin acts quickly. NPR's Michelle Kelman has more on the case from Moscow.
The head of the Presidential Pardons Commission, Anatoly Pristovkin, says members voted unanimously to free Pope on humanitarian grounds. Mr. Pope is a sick man who's gone through a lot, and he should be let go, Pristovkin said, adding he thought the sentence was too tough. The 54-year-old former naval officer was sentenced this week to 20 years in prison for buying secrets about a high-speed torpedo. He has maintained his innocence, but rather than appealing to the Supreme Court, Pope asked for a pardon. Pope's wife, Sherry, is hoping to bring him home soon, fearing the bone cancer he battled may be back. Pope's fate is now in President Putin's hands. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 95 points to close at 10,713. Advances led to declines by 5-2. This is NPR News. President Clinton has now visited all 50 states as president. The Cornhusker state lays claim to being the last. Carol Schrader reports from Nebraska Public Radio.
Students from the University of Nebraska at Kearney started lining up outside the Health and Sports Center at 2 this morning, hoping to get the best seat in the House to see the president. After being presented an honorary doctorate of humane letters, the president told the 6,000 there.
Let me say, I'm glad that I finally made it to Nebraska. There were a lot of signs outside that said you saved the best till last.
Mr. Clinton quipped about the relatively small number of Democrats in Nebraska, then went on to give a foreign policy speech. Only a handful of protesters lined the streets, far outnumbered by the hundreds of schoolchildren who waved as the motorcade passed by. After the Kearney stop, it was off to Offutt Air Force Base near Omaha for a quick address to nearly 5,000, mostly military personnel, and their families. For NPR News, I'm Carol Schrader in Kearney, Nebraska.
At least 10 people died today in violence in the West Bank and Gaza as Palestinians challenged Israeli soldiers on the anniversary of their first uprising. December 8, 1987 marked the beginning of the Intifada, the six-year revolt against Israeli occupation, and Palestinian activists had called for a day of rage against Israel. Israeli troops fired tank shells against what they said were suspicious figures in a West Bank town, killing four Palestinian policemen and a civilian. A Palestinian teenager was shot to death in Bethlehem, and another Palestinian man died near the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. Earlier today, Palestinians opened fire on an Israeli van, killing a schoolteacher and a driver. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. 20 years ago today, John Lennon was assassinated in the entranceway of his apartment building in New York City. 2 hours after his murder, at 1 a.m, 1,000 fans had already gathered at the site to mourn. In honor of the anniversary, we're featuring 2 interviews with the women who shared his life, Cynthia Lennon and Yoko Ono. Back in the 60s, when teenage girls in America and England fantasized about romance with their favorite Beatle, Cynthia Powell held the position so many girls dreamed of. She was married to John Lennon.
Wait, oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman. Wait, wait, hey, 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 Mr. Postman. Mr. Postman, look and see. Oh yeah.
Cynthia Powell and John Lennon shared a working-class background. They met in art school in 1957 and were married in 1962. During the years that John toured the world as a member of the most popular rock group in history, Cynthia was at home raising their son Julian. Cynthia and John Lennon divorced in 1968 after John fell in love with Yoko Ono. John Lennon was killed 12 years later. As her son Julian launched his own career as a musician, Cynthia Lennon developed her work as a designer. Terry Gross spoke to Cynthia in 1985. They talked about the years she was known as a Beatle wife.
You were told by Brian Epstein after a while, the Beatles' manager, that you shouldn't be too visible as the wife. They didn't want the fans to know, I think, that that Lennon was married, or at least they didn't want to play it up. I mean, how were you told that? Did he tell you that directly?
Well, he didn't exactly tell me, but he did speak to John about it. And, of course, John explained to me the situation, because in those days it wasn't done for a pop star to have a wife. It would take away from the group. And, of course, the beginning of the Beatles, Brian wanted a lot of adulation from the fans. He wanted a lot of support from the fans. And, of course, it wasn't done. If the lead, in fact, the main man in the group, who was John, was found to be married, then it might take away from that particular success. So I walked round pregnant for quite a long time, hiding it. You know, I'd wear very big blousy clothes, and in fact, I was asked many times if I was John's wife, and I had to refuse and say, no, no, I'm somebody else.
Did John feel at all uncomfortable telling his wife not to act like his wife?
Well, it wasn't a sort of husband-wife situation, really. You know, again, it's very hard to describe, because we had a son on the way, and we were married very quickly, and the Beatles started, and the music started, and the fame started, and the press. And it wasn't a sort of natural, normal husband-and-wife situation at that time.
Were you exposed to any of the groupies who were hanging around John Lennon and the other Beatles then?
Well, actually, the first experience, which was funny for all of us, when we first came to New York and we were staying at the Plaza, I think it was Murray the K was there. He was the first disc jockey that we'd ever met, American disc jockey, so I was very impressed, but he happened to be there. And in the room, there were sort of all these draped, beautiful ladies. This was their suite, Murray the K and about five beautiful model ladies all draped round. And we all walked in and looked at them and looked at each other and wondered what on earth we were supposed to do in a situation like this, because it was obvious, you know, what they were there for. And, of course, I was the fly in the ointment because I was the wife of one of the Beatles. So it was embarrassing for them and embarrassing for me. And it was a situation that clicked with me. I mean, I realised then what it was going to be like, you know, in the future. I mean, obviously, that was what it was going to be like, just women throwing themselves at them the whole time.
Well, what would you do in a situation like that? Would you be the one to leave?
No, no. I mean, in a situation like that, no. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you're not there, there's not a lot you can do about it, is there? And, you know, men are very easily tempted when they're exhausted and tired and they need not necessarily sleep. You know, I'm not being crude on this, but I mean, it's one of those situations in that sort of life.
One of the changes that he experienced, which I would assume you didn't, at least to that degree, was the introduction of marijuana and hallucinogenic drugs. I mean, the Beatles became famous for mm-hmm. that. Did you participate in any of that? Were you anxious to try it?
I was never anxious to try it. But our first experience was a friend of George's, actually, a dentist person, and we went for dinner. And after dinner, he put sugar cubes in our coffee, which were laced with LSD. And, of course, it hit us all at the same time, and we had the most horrendous night and a very dangerous drive home. We could all have been killed because we were absolutely out of our minds. And for me, that was hell, sheer hell, mental torture, and I couldn't cope with it, and I would never, ever have wanted to do it again. And yet for John, it was something else. You see, John was a different animal. He was a searcher. He desired something new in life, constantly changing, constantly wanting new experiences. And of course, he didn't have a bad time on this particular drug, so he tried it again. And then if you realize at a time like that, when there's so much money around and so many hangers-on, there are bound to be pushers, and there were pushers. We were surrounded by pushers, so there was no denying that there was plenty of supplies. You know, they didn't have to do anything. There were captive audiences to these people who are constantly pushing the drugs.
Did that create a wedge between the two of you, since yep. he was living in an altered state a lot of the time and you weren't?
Most definitely, because it's a division of two minds, really. I couldn't go along with it. I just couldn't. I hated the whole business. I could see what it was doing, not necessarily to John, but to a lot of people. Lost a lot of friends through drugs. And with John, it altered his personality for me. I mean, I just stayed the way I was, and I always have done as far as I can. I mean, I've developed and I've gone on. But John was going so fast, and I couldn't keep up with him. And I didn't want to keep up with him on that level.
What are some of the other ways you saw him changed by the fame and the money that he achieved?
I think he became extremely lethargic at home, really rather sad and tired. He just didn't have any stimulation anymore. He was losing out on concert tours. He wasn't happy in his performance because he couldn't hear himself. He wasn't getting any audience response. He wasn't close enough to the people that he was entertaining anymore. I mean, he was surrounded by adulation and material goods and all the things that other people would think were fantastic in life. But for John, it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. It wasn't honest enough.
So what did it look like he was going to turn to instead?
Well, I think what it, it was very hard to describe what he was going to turn to. I mean, he was on that particular road. We did turn to meditation and Maharishi in India.
Did you go to that?
Yes, I was there for 2 months. But he took that wholeheartedly again, and so did George, very, very deeply into meditation. And I didn't. I took half and half, sort of tried to get a balanced view of it. So I would do artwork. Half of my time was doing artwork and half of my time was doing meditation because I didn't want to get hooked on anything. You know, I think you've got to believe in yourself and your capabilities. And I think John, again, was looking for an escape. But this time it was a healthy escape. It was escape into meditation, into peace of mind, relaxation, away from the pressures. And it was at this particular time that he met Yoko. And, of course, again, before we went to India, Brian died. So the whole thing, our whole lifestyle changed again very quickly, you know, after the first time. I was constantly changing. And this was a great break and a great rift for all of us. I mean, we were all devastated by Brian's death.
How did you first meet Yoko?
I met her... Oh, where was it? Actually, when I came home from a holiday. But I had seen her before. I mean, I met her physically, we could say. And she'd been staying with John the night, and I came home and they were there, which was sort of curtains for our marriage as far as all of us were concerned, really. But I had met her once before at a meditation meeting.
You knew right from the start when you saw them together that this was it, that this was different from just having an affair with someone?
Well, I keep saying it was feminine intuition. You know that something's going to happen, and only you know that something like that is going to happen because of your sensitivity and your knowledge of the person that you've been living with for 10 years already. You know exactly what's going to happen. And as far as Yoko was concerned, I knew there was not a thing I could do about it, any more than there was anything I could do about John taking drugs at the time. There was no way I could have stopped him.
He initiated divorce proceedings, right?
Yes.
And he accused you of adultery.
Well, you see, this is the crazy, the madness of it all. I, to this day, don't understand that, but it's almost as though, I've tried to work it out, it's almost as though John's attitude in life was the best form of defense is attack. Now, he was guilty of letting me down in public. I was on holiday when the information about John and Yoko came out in the newspapers. I didn't know it was open to the world, the situation. And I was on holiday and somebody showed me a newspaper. And then an emissary of John's came over to visit me in Italy and said, John wants a divorce and he wants Julian. And there's a detective. Now, I was on holiday with my mother, my aunt and uncle, and Julian. So God only knows why there was a detective put on me. You know, it was one of those situations that I will never understand.
When John and Yoko went off together, their relationship was probably the most press-covered relationship of the year. They were on the cover of everything. Mm-hmm. They were holding press conferences in their bed. I mean, it was one big media event after another. How much of that did you want to expose yourself to? Did you read it?
Oh, I read everything, yes. Because, of course, the man that we had divorced, it didn't mean to say I'd stopped loving him or caring for him or worrying about him. I mean, because I didn't have any anger or bitterness about it. I had a lot of hurt. But of course I was looking after his interests in my own little way and caring about his future and hoping that he was happy because he'd had to go through such hell to do what he did. And he became almost a leper in the eyes of the British and the press. And he had hell to go through because he broke away from the system of being one of the four mop tops that were doing so well and such good ambassadors for Britain. And he moved out of that and he became an individual. And he did what he wanted, to the extreme, as John would always do anyway. And I felt extremely worried for him, really, at that time, because he had to take so much from the press and media and from fans and people who loved him.
How do you think his personality was changed by the relationship?
I think he found found his space. I don't think he found the complete satisfaction in life, because I think he was always searching, always looking for it, always wanting something new, always... I mean, he was due to come back to England, you know, near the end, of just before he died. So he was constantly changing and looking for new quests. But whatever he did, it was totally honest and wholehearted.
Cynthia Lennon speaking with Terry Gross in 1985. Coming up, Yoko Ono. This is Fresh Air.
I love you.
Most of us know Yoko Ono through her relationship with John Lennon. But before they met, Ono was an avant-garde artist living in New York, where her circle of friends included John Cage, Merce Cunningham, and Lamont Young. After Lennon was murdered, Ono spent years in relative seclusion, finally re-emerging to the public through her art. A retrospective of Yoko Ono's early work, called Yes, Yoko Ono, opened at the Japan Society Gallery in New York this October. Terry spoke with Yoko Ono in 1989.
There was a lot of hostile reaction to you when you and John first got together. And I was wondering if you think it would have been different had you not been Asian, had you been a little bit younger, you were a few years older than John, and had you not had a kind of weird art career of your own. Do you think that you were punished in a way by the public for any of those things?
Well, yes, probably, you know. Well, we all know that, don't we? But I think that now, I think it was something that we went through together, all of us. It was a lesson, a learning for us, in a way. If you observed closely, you would have noticed that the age difference is really, I mean, the physical age difference really didn't mean very much. I mean, now most people, I mean, some women would live with somebody who's 30 years younger and all that, nobody's surprised. I was only 8 years older than John, and John was a very worldly man by then. In a strange sort of way, I was not as worldly as him. So in that sense, I looked up to him in many ways. And in some ways, he was my daddy, you know, father figure too, you know. And so between us, we never felt the sort of difference of age or something like that, you know.
Do you think your work was seen differently after you and John got together, your artwork?
Definitely, definitely.
How?
Well, I was just an artist before that, and then I became Mrs. Lennon, you know. And there's a piece called Box of Smile. I was still sort of, didn't understand my position, you know, looking from outside, that is. I didn't understand how I looked. So I was still feeling like an artist and just went on creating things. So it was very natural for me to try to put a Box of Smile out in the world. And I put an ad in the Village Voice saying was it $2 or $5? Very cheap. You know, $5 a box or something like that, you know. And then somebody, I think it's one of the rock critics or something, you know, sort of, and he was visiting John and me and so saying, why are you selling your artwork, you know? And I was saying, well, why not, you know, and he said, well, I mean, you're Mrs. Lennon, and you should be giving it away, you know. And he, oh, dear, charity lady, you know, what is this, you know? And you wouldn't say that to John, why don't you give away records? I mean, what are we talking about, you know? And there was a big sort of discussion, you know. But basically, that was the kind of natural feeling people had. I think, well, she's Mrs. Lennon, you know. What's she doing anyway? I mean, she doesn't have to work anymore, you know. So, I don't know. I just went on creating things. But then in 71, I think, we did an Everson Museum show, which was in Syracuse. And I say we because John was a guest artist and I wanted him to be a guest artist, really, and it was really nice. But, I mean, for us it was a great celebration because it was opening was on John's birthday and I felt that I was sort of doing the show for him and all that kind of thing. But I think most people queued up to see John, you know. And, well, that's another kind of event, another kind of happening. It was okay, but there was no point in creating the kind of pieces that I was creating.
I've thought of you over the past few years as living a very secluded life. And I was actually really surprised when I found out that you would be willing to do an interview. Is this a sign of a change in your life, of being a little more public? Because after being going through a very public period, you went through years of a very private period. Are you coming out of that now? Is this a sign of that?
Well, I think that there was a private period that was very necessary because sometimes it's like breathing in and out. You know, you just have to go inside yourself. And that period was the Dakota period or whatever you call it. And then we came out with the Double Fantasy. And from then on, I think we would have been pretty public for a while, you know. I, again, went into hiding in some ways because of what happened, and I just couldn't sort of deal with it in a way, and I needed to hide. But even while I was hiding, I think, you know, there's some statements that I put out or whatever. I was in touch with life itself, you know. It wasn't like I sort of denied it all, you know, and sort of shut myself out of it. I don't think I was part of society.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Yoko Ono from a 1989 interview. This fall, Yoko Ono opened the John Lennon Museum in Japan. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Karma's gonna get you. Gonna knock you right on the head.
Coming up, deportation, FBI surveillance, and the efforts that in effect silenced Lennon. A talk with John Wiener about the FBI's secret files on Lennon and the days when rock music had political power. And Henry Sheehan reviews Proof of Life, starring Meg Ryan and Russell Crowe.
Together, darling. Join the human race. How in the world are you gonna see? Laughing at fools like me. Who on earth do you think you are? A superstar?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we're commemorating the 20th anniversary of John Lennon's assassination.
Two, one, two, three, four.
Anti-war music like Give Peace a Chance didn't exactly endear John Lennon to the Nixon administration. In 1971, shortly after John Lennon arrived in New York on a visa and had hooked up with radical anti-war activists, the FBI put Lennon under surveillance. The Immigration and Naturalization Service tried to deport him. John Wiener is a historian who investigated what the FBI and the INS did to Lennon between 1971 and 72. After Lennon was murdered, Wiener requested Lennon's FBI files under the Freedom of Information Act. 14 years later, after the case went to the Supreme Court, the FBI agreed to release all but 10 of the documents. Terry spoke with John Wiener earlier this year. His book about the FBI files is called Gimme Some Truth. It opens with a memo from Senator Strom Thurmond to the Nixon White House about an upcoming Beatle tour of the United States, which warned that John Lennon might combine rock music with politics and organize young people to vote against Nixon in the 1972 election. Thurmond's memo also suggested that terminating Lennon's visa might be an effective countermeasure.
Well, a little historical background here. The 72 election was going to be the first in which 18-year-olds had the right to vote. Before that, you had to be 21. Everybody knew that young people were the strongest anti-war constituency, but also all real politicos know that then, and as well as today, young people are the least likely to vote. So the question was, for Lennon, how could he use his power as a celebrity to get young people into the political process? And also, this is a time when kids are very alienated from, you know, mainstream politics. So to get Lennon out of the country, the strategic countermeasure is to deport Lennon so he won't be able to take this this tour that would register young voters. At the same time, they're worried that, you know, young voters will vote against Nixon for kicking out, you know, the clever Beatle.
Now, how accurate was the FBI's information that John Lennon did want to help organize these political concerts that would be for peace and against Nixon?
There's no question that Lennon was talking about this with his friends being Jerry Rubin, Abbie Hoffman, Bobby Seale. And they tried doing one of these. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, in December 1971, John and Yoko headlined a political rock concert, the Free John Sinclair Concert. Every once in a while, I run into somebody who was there. 15,000 people spent 6 hours in Chrysler Arena. They listened not only to John and Yoko, but Stevie Wonder came, Commander Cody came, the MC5 came, William Kunstler gave a speech, Jerry Rubin gave a speech, Bobby Seale gave a speech. And a lot of it was about, you know, mobilizing young people to oppose Nixon. So they were very excited. John and Yoko were very excited about the tremendous turnout they had for this concert and how successful it was. So they were interested in the idea. They never got to the stage of setting up the national concert tour because the deportation order came down just 2 months later.
How far did the INS get in deporting Lennon?
Well, for much of 1972 and 73, Lennon was under an order to leave the country within 60 days. He had very talented legal help, and they kept getting these deadlines extended. There was a lot of people mobilized to support him, but it wasn't until after Watergate, after Nixon left office, that the Gerald Ford administration Immigration Service finally agreed to grant Lennon his green card on a very narrow legal ground. So for 2 years, he was under a 60-day order to leave the country almost continuously.
Now, let's talk more about the FBI documents that you were finally able to get through the Freedom of Information Act. You say that the FBI documents make the FBI look more like the Keystone Cops than the Gestapo. Give us an example of one of the documents that you think makes them look like Keystone Cops.
Well, there's one where they J. Edgar Hoover sends out instructions to locate Lennon as quickly as possible. They say his last known address is St. Regis Hotel, 150 Bank Street, New York City. Now, every cop and cab driver in New York knows that the St. Regis Hotel, you know, is on Central Park. It's not, and that Bank Street is in the West Village, so this couldn't be right. In fact, Lennon at the time was living on Bank Street, but he was living at 105 Bank Street, not 150 Bank Street. So here's like this all points bulletin, you know, find Lennon. They're just confused. I mean, it could have happened to any of us, I guess. The other really strange one is that there's a kind of a wanted poster for Lennon. The FBI proposed that Lennon should be arrested, if at all possible, on possession of narcotics charges. I'm quoting now from one of the documents, which would make him more immediately deportable. And these instructions to local police officials include a kind of a wanted poster, a picture of Lennon, you know, height, weight, eye color, and so on. You'd think that they wouldn't really need this. Lennon was certainly one of the most recognizable faces in the world in 1972. They have a picture there anyway, but the strangest thing is the picture isn't of John Lennon. It's of another guy. A guy, I mean, I know who it is. It's a guy named David Peel, who was an East Village folk singer, street singer, busker type, who looked a little like Lennon. I mean, he wore the wire-rimmed glasses and had Lennon's style of long hair. Of course, lots of other people did in 1972. David Peel had recorded on Apple Records. Maybe that's how they got confused. So the FBI, you know, was lamentably out of touch with the mainstream, not just of, you know, the radical counterculture of New York City, but you would think John Lennon is kind of pretty much the mainstream in 1972.
Well, the funny thing is that the FBI documents, like, for instance, there's a memo from Hoover in which he describes Lennon as something like a member of the singing group The Beatles, as if, like, you know, as if, like, who The Beatles are really needs to be explained.
You know, I've always been fascinated by that sentence. This is in J. Edgar Hoover's letter to H.R. Haldeman. And the first sentence is, John Winston Lennon is a member of the Beatles singing group. Now, what I'm not sure is it that J. Edgar Hoover wants to prove that he knows what the Beatles are and the names of the Beatles? Or is it that he thinks that Nixon does not know who John Lennon is? Or that it's this John Lennon, the John Lennon who's the Beatle, is the one we're talking about here? I've never been able to figure out which of those is the case.
Did you find anything in the FBI files that were released to you that indicated that the FBI went beyond surveillance, that they ever tried to set Lennon up?
Yeah, there's a couple of documents. Their concern was that Lennon would participate in some kind of concert, rally, anti-war demonstration outside the Republican National Convention. And there's a memo from J. Edgar Hoover to the head of the Miami FBI office that suggests that if Lennon could be arrested on possession of narcotics charges, he would become more immediately deportable. Now, this seems to me an effort to set Lennon up for a drug bust. The FBI doesn't enforce possession of narcotics charges. That's a state offense. This is not part of what the FBI is supposed to be doing. I then filed a Freedom of Information request with the Miami FBI office, asking for their files on Lennon to see what their response to this was. They replied to me that their John Lennon file had been destroyed as a part of a routine file destruction procedure.
Hmm.
Now, I have to note that Lennon files were collected in five other cities, and none of those places destroyed their Lennon files. So we wonder what was in the Miami Lennon file that was destroyed.
My guest is historian John Wiener, author of the new book, Gimme Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Wiener. He's a historian and author of the new book, Give Me Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files. And he tried to get those files for about 14 years in a series of lawsuits. Now, you have the FBI document that explains why the FBI stopped its surveillance of Lennon. Would you summarize and read an excerpt of that document for us?
This is dated August 30th, 1972. This is like 2 months before the presidential election. This is a memo to the acting director. Now, that's L. Patrick Gray. J. Edgar Hoover had died in May. From the special agent in charge of the New York FBI office. It says, "For the past several months, there has been no information received to indicate that the subject is active in the new left." Then it indicates what the sources are. "All advised that during the month of July 1972 that the subject has fallen out of favor of activists Jerry Rubin, Stuart Albert, and Rennie Davis due to subject's lack of interest in committing himself to involvement in anti-war and new left activities. In view of this information, the New York division is placing this case in a pending inactive status."
Now, is that true of the whole FBI or just the New York division?
Well, New York was the office of origin, the OO, as it's called in the files. They're the ones who are responsible for conducting the investigation. I mean, what this really is saying here is that the Immigration Service and the FBI have succeeded in pressuring Lennon to cancel his plans for this national concert tour and to withdraw from anti-war activity. His lawyers told him that his case for fighting deportation was a pretty weak one. In fact, they'd never seen anyone win a case under these terms. And therefore, the legal advice was don't do anything more that would further provoke the Nixon administration. He really wanted to stay in the United States. Yoko was involved at that point in a custody dispute over her daughter from a previous marriage, her daughter Kyoko. John, if he had been deported, Yoko would have stayed behind. He didn't want to be separated from Yoko, so he canceled the plans for the concert tour. He dropped out of movement activity, and the FBI is reporting that they've accomplished their job.
So in that sense, the FBI did succeed in neutralizing, as they like to put it, in neutralizing John Lennon.
Yeah, neutralizing is one of the scary words which appear in the file. Some people think this refers, you know, to assassination plans or something like that. I don't think that's the case. Neutralizing means silencing him, getting him out of the picture through this deportation threat. And there's no question that Lennon was silenced as a spokesman of the anti-war movement.
How much do you think John Lennon knew about the FBI's surveillance of him?
Well, he understood that this whole deportation thing was politically motivated. He complained publicly on TV shows, on the Mike Douglas show, on the Dick Cavett show, you know, these criminal enterprises, that too many people were coming to fix his phones down on Bank Street in the West Village, and that there were strange men outside in suits who followed him around. He eventually sued the FBI, claiming he had been the target of illegal wiretapping. Part of his FBI file is the FBI's own response to that charge. They replied that they could find no evidence of authorized wiretapping in their files. Now, this seems to me like a typical Nixon-era non-denial denial. They said they could find no evidence, but maybe they didn't look very hard. They said they could find no evidence of authorized wiretapping, but it could have been unauthorized. It's also possible that the wiretapping was not done by the FBI, but was done by the New York police or some other agency. So Lennon sometimes thought he was just being paranoid. He would say, you know, he wasn't important enough to be the target of this kind of surveillance. At other times, he loudly proclaimed that he was the target of government persecution. It turns out it's the second that was correct, but he never was sure in his own time that it was the FBI that was after him.
Do you have evidence that his phone really was tapped?
There are no wiretapping logs in the Lennon FBI file of the kind that there are, say, in the Martin Luther King file. So, mm-hmm. This remains an open question. I mean, he lived next door to John Cage on Bank Street, and whenever he needed to make a, it's the 60s. It's the West Village in the 60s. Whenever he needed to make, a secure conversation, they would go next door and use John Cage's phone in the belief that the FBI didn't know who John Cage was. They were probably right about that.
Right. The FBI wasn't interested in chance music, huh?
Probably not.
Has reading all the files about John Lennon, the FBI files, changed your impressions of Lennon? I mean, there are insights from from these informant documents. Has it added to your knowledge of John Lennon, the man, added to your knowledge of his character or how he behaved in the world?
Well, no, this is a period which people don't pay very much attention to anymore when they're remembering Lennon. It was really less than 12 months. But reading these files, you get a sense of just what an intense and devastating period this was for Lennon. That he starts out full of enthusiasm, high hopes, going to do this concert tour. He hadn't performed live for 5 years. Excited to be in New York, the center of the universe. Within a couple of months, he is feeling the heavy hand of the government of the most powerful country in the world, which, wants to get rid of him, wants to kick him out. And it really, I think it ruined his life for the next few years. And it's easier to see, what happened to him. And the next year, his music kind of falls apart. His couple of albums that he makes here are, pretty much the worst of his career. He breaks up with Yoko, moves out to L.A. on the so-called Lost Weekend, living the life of a kind of over-the-hill rock star. I think all of this is, I don't know how much he understood at the time, but this is sort of the time when he's lost his optimism, he's lost his hope, he's been punished for not doing very much. And he paid a heavy price, both as a creative person and in his own life.
You say in your book that one of the things you really find fascinating about these FBI files is that they document an era when rock music seemed to have real political force. Say some more about that.
Well, it's a little hard to believe today that a president would fear the power of a rock star. Rock stars often today have political causes, but they're usually the safe ones, save the rainforest or fight breast cancer or something like that, issues that nobody is going to, try to deport you for advocating. It's still hard to figure out whether the effort to deport Lennon was complete paranoia on Nixon's part. After all, Nixon did win the 1972 election by an overwhelming landslide. His opponent, George McGovern, carried, two or three states, something like that. So maybe the whole thing was just paranoia on the part of Nixon matched by paranoia on the part of Lennon and his friends. On the other hand, all of this was put in motion long before that presidential election, in the winter beforehand. And at that point, I don't think it was clear to anybody that Nixon was going to win in a landslide. Nixon was concerned about this youth vote and how that might affect the elections. Wasn't clear that McGovern was going to be the candidate. There's a lot of reasons not to like Richard Nixon. I never liked him very much myself. But, he was one of the most successful political candidates in recent history. So I'm kind of willing to accept Nixon's judgment that Lennon's political plans for 1972 were significant, were interesting, and did merit some kind of presidential response.
And that's something that you find interesting about the times, and something that you admire Lennon for.
Yeah, I mean, Lennon really took risks here of a kind that you hardly see anybody ever taking. How many people in the entertainment world have faced deportation because of their political actions? I mean, Charlie Chaplin was sort of run out of the United States. Paul Robeson left, it was sort of the opposite, where he was denied the right to travel, and then he left the, you know, anyway. Bertolt Brecht fled after being quizzed by HUAC. This is a very small group of people. So I think it underscores the intensity of Lenin's commitment. I mean, I don't think he knew the risks he was taking, but that's sort of what he was like. He was a risk taker. He wanted to stand up for what he believed in. He wasn't going to play it safe. It wasn't a safe age. So I think that's admirable.
Well, John Wiener, I thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
John Wiener's book is Gimme Some Truth. Terry spoke with him earlier this year. Coming up, a review of the new movie, Proof of Life. This is Fresh Air. The Australian actor Russell Crowe first made his mark playing edgy, difficult characters in a series of ambitious films. Now, after the likes of Romper Stomper, Proof, and L.A. Confidential, the star of the summer hit Gladiator takes on another action role in Proof of Life. He plays a commando for hire who specializes in rescuing kidnap victims. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
Hollywood action movies long ago ceased demanding much from their stars beyond a few wisecracks and buffed muscles. You're dating yourself if you can remember when the action scene was dominated by performers who could not only pull a trigger, but actually pull off a characterization. Actors such as Steve McQueen, Sean Connery, and the era's last standing hero, Clint Eastwood. So the fact that Russell Crowe has turned up in the intelligent international thriller Proof of Life is cause for some celebration. It's not that the movie is a masterpiece. At over 2 hours, it's about a half hour too long. It's over-explicit when it comes to setting up relationships, and director Taylor Hackford sometimes forgets he's making a big-time shoot-'em-up, not adapting Dostoevsky. But this yarn about a professional hired gun who specializes in rescuing hostages from paramilitary groups does show us what Crowe can do with action material. For one thing, as former British Army commando Terry Thorne, Crowe never loses his cool. Whether in battle fatigues or, more often, a neat black suit, he never furrows his brow, raises his voice, or even breaks a sweat, which is a good trick when you are in Talaca, the mythical, mountainous South American country where the action is set. Co-star Meg Ryan, who plays Alice Bowman, handles most of the emotional displays. Her husband, a construction engineer named Peter Bowman, has been kidnapped by drug smugglers and extortionists. At first, Peter's employers agree to foot the bill for his ransom, engaging the international security firm that employs Thorne. But corporate chicanery intervenes, and Thorne, who has already started work on the case, is ordered to leave town. In this scene, Alice beseeches Thorne to stay and rescue her husband.
I'm not even supposed to talk to you.
So this is what? This is you being brave?
No, this is me doing my job.
Well, it's good I came by then, right, soldier? Let you get that off your chest.
I'm sure it's all gonna work out.
Hey, you know they're giving us some local security guy? They're giving us exactly the kind of guy you warned me about.
I don't know what to tell you. I don't have my policy.
Great. So when this is over, and my husband's dead, and I'm suing the heck out of these suits, you can tell the judge you did everything you could to help me out? Wait a minute. Wait! Listen to me, I'm sorry. All right, I apologize. I'm sorry to be like this. But you are the first, you are the only person I've met who knows what they're talking about. So I am begging you, I am totally begging you to help me out on this.
You asked me to be straight with you, right?
Right.
I got a plane to catch.
You can hear how the two stars complement each other. With Ryan emoting like mad, Crow can keep to his understated murmur. What you can't see is how dynamic a presence Crow is, and not just because of his muscular good looks. Crow's real strength, the one that makes him a likely successor to the great action stars, is his eyes. Action heroes must always be shown looking, checking out allies and foes, taking in the landscape, measuring distances, just generally calculating. But paradoxically, they must also have the ability not to look. That's because a good action hero is always uncomfortable in the presence of his superiors, especially when he's a member of the British Commonwealth. Scottish Sean Connery and Cockney Michael Caine each sported unfashionable accents, so filmmakers always tried to pair them off with toffee-nosed London bosses whose own accents marked them as social superiors. But these heroes did what they did not because they were told to, but because they responded to an inner compulsion. In the presence of their la-di-da bosses, their eyes would glaze over or look down or to the side. They had to be physically present, this gesture said, but mentally, they were gone. Proof of Life gives the Australian-born Thorne the familiar set of British upper-class bosses, if only to prove that the man of action is the natural aristocrat. A classic action hero responds to chivalry's call even, or especially, when it runs counter to a business agenda. Of course, Thorne still has to blow stuff up. Proof of Life opens and closes with terrific large-scale action scenes that put Thorne's bloody competency beyond question. And throughout the movie, he faces down one bad guy after another with steely nerve. Crow isn't the whole show here. The movie spends a lot of time with the kidnapped Peter, who is well played by David Morse. A slate of talented supporting players, which includes Pamela Reed and David Caruso, also get their moments. But it's Crow's internalized dynamic which gives the movie all the proof of life it needs.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of The Colwood Way, a memoir, new from Homer Hickam, author of October Sky. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Simon explains how he and Art Garfunkel went from being the singing duo of Tom and Jerry to Simon and Garfunkel. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
May 12 angels guard you while you sleep. Maybe that's a waste of angels, I don't know.